both Aquinas' teaching on the ultimate end and St. John of the Cross' teaching can be seen as kind of stark, harsh almost, you might say. St. John of the Cross teaches that you have to go through these dark nights, and St. Thomas teaches that there has to be only one ultimate end for all that you do. St. John of the Cross teaches that there are three major stages of the spiritual life. So there's the beginner and the proficient and the perfect. And in between, you have these dark nights. This will be the dark night of the senses. And this will be the dark night of the soul or of the spirit, I guess. And it's sometimes thought that, this is a teaching he gives about people who are mystics in the sense of having mystical visions, or people who are just contemplatives rather than people who are in the active life. But I don't think that's a fair reading of what he has to say. What he's saying is everyone who really wants to grow in the spiritual life has to go through these stages. as I said, these dark nights are pretty stark and gloomy-sounding things. But then Christianity in the form of Jesus Christ often seems very harsh in some sense. Jesus tells the rich young man to sell all that he has and give it to the poor. He says, if your eye causes you to sin, then you should pluck it out. He says you have to leave everything to follow him, everything, and you don't even have time to say farewell to your family. Probably most starkly, he says, anyone who wants to be his disciple must hate his father and mother, his wife and children. Now, Aquinas' teaching on the ultimate end can also appear kind of stark and harsh. As I said, he says that we must order all of our actions to one single ultimate end, ultimately the vision of God. And if we fail in this, we sin at least venially. Maybe to make this sound worse than it is, if you decided to watch a movie just for its own sake or read a novel, then that would seem like it's a venial sin. Now, this is softened quite a bit by the recognition that we don't always have to have the ultimate end before our minds. If we did, we'd all be in trouble when we take tests. You know, taking a math test, and you always have to be thinking about the ultimate end, you're probably not going to do very well on the math test. Right? So he says that we can order our actions either virtually or habitually to the ultimate end. If you're driving to the grocery store to get food, you don't always have to be thinking about the food as you're driving. Hopefully you're thinking about the stoplights or this turn or that turn that you have to take. But nevertheless, your driving is still ordered to the end of getting food, right? Not actively, consciously now, but either habitually or virtually is the terminology that Aquinas says. So it could be the case that you've recognized that, watching movies is something good for you. If you never did that sort of thing, you'd be a grumpy person and you wouldn't be good for proclaiming the gospel. And so you've recognized that it's ordered to the end, and now you're watching the movie and maybe you're not thinking about how it's ordered to the end, but that's still okay, right? It wouldn't be a venial sin in that case. Even once you bring this into play, though, you still end up with a doctrine of Aquinas that seems pretty strict. It seems like everything has to be a means to the divine good. Maybe we don't always have to think about the divine good, but ultimately all of our desires have to rest in this one good. All other goods might appear, then, to be mere means, and never to be desired for their own sake. Even something that would be very good, like spending time with your friends, you might say, well, gee, but that's only insofar it's ordered to God, not for the sake of the friends themselves. This has given rise to what has come to be called the new natural law theory. It sort of began with Aquinas, but has drifted pretty far away from Aquinas. Founded by a philosopher / theologian by the name of Germain Grisez. He says there is not one single ultimate end for our lives, but rather he talks about seven basic goods. None of these is more significant than another. So that, for instance, the good of religion, which is one of his basic goods, is not above the good of knowledge. Nor is the good of knowledge above the good of play. Each good is desired for its own sake and depends upon no further good for its desirability. In contrast, for Aquinas, the good of play, under which you might include reading the novel or watching the movie, always has to be desired insofar as it's ordered to the divine good. The desire of play, for Grisez, does not depend upon some further good, but for Aquinas, it must. It can't be desired just as a full stopping point. All right, so that gives a picture of the two views that we're going to look at, and we want to look at them in a little more detail. And common to both of them is a psychology that you got a little bit of background to last night, so I won't spend too much time looking at it. But importantly, we're going to find four powers that come into play here. One is reason, by which we understand the world around us as well as God. Another is imagination, which is, in Thomistic terminology, a sensible power. That is, with it, you call to mind images in the broad sense of image, of pictures, sounds, things like this. Both of these are knowing powers in the sense that you're grasping the world, taking in the world, so to speak. Then the other two powers that are very important are the will and the emotions, which I believe Father Pine spoke fairly extensively about last night. So we'll talk more about these two because it's the appetites, these will and emotions, that'll be most important. We're all familiar with the emotions. We could use the word desire broadly to speak of things like fear, enjoyment, hatred, love, desire itself being one of the emotions. But the word is also used broadly to refer to any sort of affective movement that we might have. We move out to things with our desires, including the desires of our emotions, different from the knowing powers where you're taking in something. The will is also a desiring power, so it also could have desire, fear, enjoyment, hatred, love, but it's dramatically different from the emotions. And in two ways, and both of them will be ways that it relates to knowledge. The first is the kind of knowledge from which it arises. That is, all desires have to arise from some knowledge. So if you desire to have pizza, it's only because you know something about pizza, that it tastes good or it's nutritious or something like that. If you had no idea what pizza was, nothing good about it, you couldn't desire it in any way. So you have to have knowledge before you can have desire. But different kinds of knowledge underlie the emotions and the will. Underlying the emotions is the sensible knowledge and the imagination that we spoke of. And underlying the will is the power of reason. And reason and will, then, will be spiritual powers that we have. The second way that they differ is in how we know these acts. So one is what knowledge gives rise to them. The other is how we know them. that we actually know our emotions at a sensible level in the sense that we can feel them. They involve bodily changes, our heart beating faster or our muscles tightening up, and we actually feel that sensibly within us. Whereas the will, well, that's a spiritual act. You can't feel it. So you know it, insofar as you know it, through reason. Now, between these two appetites, the will is by far the most important, right? You will be saved or damned based upon your will, not based upon your emotions. All right, so with this background in mind, we can turn then first to look a little bit more at Aquinas and then St. John of the Cross. So in all of our actions, we must seek one ultimate end, as I've said. And only one ultimate end is the true ultimate end for human beings. So various people might pursue money as an ultimate end, pleasure or fame as an ultimate end, but these are misguided ultimate ends. We all have to be pursuing something as if it's the ultimate end of our life, but there's only one thing that's truly the ultimate end of our life, and that thing is the divine good in which we share through the vision of God. Now, as I've mentioned, Germain Griset and the New Natural Law don't like this idea. They take it to be an unrealistic conclusion that one single good will satisfy all our desires. More realistically, says Griset, we all want a multiplicity of goods. That seems to be our experience in this life, right? We want knowledge, health, friendship, relaxation. And not any one single of these goods seems to satisfy all our desires. And if, in fact, one good did satisfy all of our desires, claims Griset, then the others wouldn't really be good. They would only be usefully good in order to bring about this one inherent good. So that includes, for Griset, the vision of God. If the vision of God satisfied all of our desires, then the other goods would cease to be good. So somewhat repugnantly to me, Germain Griset says that God does not satisfy all of our desires. Now, Aquinas clearly would disavow Griset's conclusion. Knowledge of God is not the only inherent good, even though it is the ultimate end and it does satisfy all of our desires. We can and also do take satisfaction in other goods such as friendship, knowledge, health, pleasure. Now, friendship is ultimately a good that involves the will much more than the emotions. Obviously, we take emotional pleasure with our friends, but if all we had was emotional satisfaction in our friends, that wouldn't be a true friendship. The deeper joy in friendship is found in the will. Griset seems to be saying, well, but if you're saying only God satisfies, then you can't really take any satisfaction in your will with your friends, and Aquinas is saying, no, I can have it both ways. I can have one ultimate end and yet have it that we have multiple goods that we take satisfaction in. So we'll return to that. Right now we're going to turn our attention to John of the Cross. John of the Cross follows Aquinas in this, and the Carmelites typically are Thomistic in the history of the church. So John of the Cross gives you a couple quotes. He says, for instance, to love is to labor, to divest and deprive oneself for God of all that is not God. So that seems pretty strong. There's only one thing here, God, that ultimately matters. Or another quote, God is exalted in the soul in two ways. First, the heart and joy of will are withdrawn from all that is not God and concentrated upon him alone. I don't have the second way, but all I needed was the first way. Third quote, charity also empties and annihilates the affections and appetites of the will of whatever is not God and centers them on him alone. So you get this strong teaching of Aquinas found in John of the Cross, and that's going to crop up then when we look at these dark nights. Now, most souls do not love God alone. That's because of an imperfection in our love. So John of Cross is basically saying, until you get here, you still have attachments to worldly goods in various ways, more or less, obviously. But we haven't reached this state that he's saying in those quotes I just gave you that we want to reach. Because most people are taking satisfaction in things apart from God, including bodily pleasure, material possessions, praise of others, John of the Cross says that their desires must be purified. They must come to desire God alone. This purification can take two forms, either active or passive. Active is what we're doing in Lent, right, where you do various penances or various things like this to try to correct your desires, right? So that's active. And then there's passive, which is the dark nights of the soul. Passive means that God is the one initiating it, not us, right? God is the one who's initiating it. So what you get, both of these sometimes by John of the Cross are called dark nights, but usually the dark nights just refer to the passive, which are these two here. But he will speak of this, the beginner stage and the proficient stage, as active dark nights sometimes. But one way or another, they're certainly active purifications. So what are these dark nights, which... we had a question on. Let's look at this a little bit more. The dark nights, says John of the Cross, are dreadful to the soul that undergoes them. They end up focusing the heart of the individual upon God, but during the dark night, God seems to be absent. So the soul no longer feels the presence of God, cannot focus his or her thoughts upon God, finds no relish in the spiritual life and no satisfaction in his or her own accomplishments. She sees in herself only weakness and inadequacy. There's a kind of odd inversion that goes on in these dark nights, that the individual is being purified in the satisfaction in anything but God. Yet during the dark nights, the soul can't take satisfaction in God himself or in the things of God. And this tips us off that the purification is not just the purification of our satisfaction in pleasures or fames or possessions. More profoundly, it's a purification of the satisfaction we take in God himself. We must indeed be satisfied in God and in God alone, but we have to have the right kind of satisfaction. I'll get a little bit more into that. But first, the two different kinds of dark nights correspond to the two appetites that we've seen. So the dark night of the senses, that's going to correspond to the emotions, and the dark night of the spirit is going to correspond to the will. So the dark night of the senses... the beginner, which, by the way, John of the Cross thinks most people in the spiritual life, even those who are serious about the spiritual life, right, not just your Sunday Catholic, but those would be more devoted than that, most of them, unfortunately, remain here. I don't know exactly what most means, no percentages given, but many do, right? And they have to go through these dark nights to move forward. So in the dark night of the senses, the emotions are purified, as I say, because the beginner is apt to find great emotional satisfaction in the things of God. She will spend long hours in prayer, filled with sweet love of God, will find great pleasure in fasting and in other acts of self-denial. This person is on fire with love of God. The spiritual life is a pleasure to them. But then comes the dark night of the senses. They are plunged into darkness. Prayer is no longer pleasant. They can't even think about God that much during prayer. Self-denial is no longer a joy, it's insipid. Their acts of sacrifice, they find only their own weakness and inadequacy. They recognize that much of their life has been focused upon, not upon God, but upon themselves. Paradoxically, the darkness arises because God is pouring himself forth into the soul. God is more present than ever, though the soul can't feel it. It's kind of like coming out of a dark cave into the bright sunlight. The light is much more intense than it was in the cave, but the light is so bright you can't see. So God is pouring himself into the soul. He is now so bright that the soul cannot see God present there. The sensible satisfactions that the beginner used to take in spiritual things was an occasion for a kind of sensible delight. But really, the soul was enjoying almost the senses, the sensible satisfaction, more than God himself. Maybe more than, that's too strong, I'll confess. Not more than God himself. But they were enjoying the sensible satisfaction quite a bit. So with our will, we got the two desiring powers. With our will, we can take satisfaction in the emotions, right? So when you're angry and you get back at somebody and there's a kind of emotional charge there, the will can take satisfaction in that. Or just if you're eating a good meal, your emotions take satisfaction in the food, and then the will takes satisfaction in the emotions. So if the emotions are taking satisfaction in prayer, what's the will doing? Is it taking satisfaction in God or taking satisfaction in the emotions? Well, a lot of times it can be taking satisfaction in the emotions. Remember, the beginner is on fire with love for God. On fire with love for God means in the emotions there is this charge, so to speak. Well, they might be taking a lot of satisfaction in the emotions themselves, right, rather than simply the divine things. And so they're really being purified of their satisfaction in God, right? How are you going to be satisfied in God? Just as a way of getting a kind of emotional charge, or God himself? So the dark night of the senses are said to purify the emotions, and they do. But more profoundly, they actually purify the will's relation to the emotions. Because the emotions no longer find satisfaction or delight in God, the will now can't take satisfaction in this delight. God to the will is not this sweet emotional satisfaction, but the will has to be confronted with God himself. Ultimately, the soul has to learn to rest in this kind of emptiness and nothingness. At the level of the senses, God really is nothing, because the senses can't grasp God, right? So they've been used to having this kind of sensible charge, but they have to learn to put that aside. We are all weak human beings, and we want sensible confirmation. Yes, I love God. How do I know that? Because I feel love for God, right? We want that. But during the dark night of the senses, we can't have it. So the soul is left with obscurity. God is known only in darkness. In the end, the dark night brings loving knowledge of God. So two ways you might know your friend. You know, you can know lots of facts about a friend. The way you might know facts about George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or something like that. But you also know your friend effectively, in the heart, right? You know your friend in the heart. And God is pouring himself forth in this dark night, and the kind of knowledge that the person has is now knowledge of the heart, right, about God, right? A kind of knowledge that can't be placed into concepts. And they're not used to that. And so to them, that's no knowledge at all, right? Because they're not comfortable with this. So the soul has to learn to become satisfied not with the idols of their own conceptions, but with a God who always remains beyond anything that he or she can grasp. It's kind of the, in Aquinas, the apophatic way, right? We can't know a whole lot. So that's dark night of the senses. Dark night of the spirit. Dark night of the senses is said to be dreadful, but in comparison to the dark night of the spirit, it's child's play, as far as John of the Cross is concerned. So after a time in the dark night of the senses, this could be weeks or months, maybe even longer. In the dark night of the senses, the individual becomes detached from these things of the senses, no longer expects to find sensible pleasure in divine things, and they've become comfortable with the discomforting, obscure presence of God. In short, they've come out of the dark night of the senses. They've moved into this proficient stage, which is apt to be a pretty long stage of the person's life in the spiritual development. In this transition from dark night of the senses to the proficient, God's action hasn't changed. All that's changed is the attitude of the soul, right? Here, in the dark night, they couldn't stand it. It was so uncomfortable because they weren't used to it. Here, they've gotten used to it, right? Basically, that's what's gone on in the transition to this proficient stage. Now, although they've been purified in many ways, many imperfections remain. And these have to be purified in the dark night of the spirit. Again, many attachments to things have to be taken care of, and now we're focusing more upon the will than upon the emotions. I mentioned, actually, the dark night of the senses involves a purification of the will, but this purification in the dark night of the spirit is much more of the will. Once again, most profoundly, the purification won't be of the attachments to pleasure or money or praise. It will be that. I'm not denying that. But more profoundly, it's going to be a detachment from the soul's attitude towards God. The soul must learn to depend entirely on God. No creature can provide a comfort. You can see the connection with Aquinas' stark teaching on the ultimate end. Most importantly, the person has to cease depending upon him or herself. In the bright light that now shines upon the soul, it's the bright light of divine love. What the soul sees in herself is only vileness and impurity. She recognizes that by her own strength she can do nothing. She has for many years, perhaps, thought herself unworthy of God's favor, but she has yearned to be worthy. She has wanted God's gift not to be entirely an act of mercy. She's wanted to deserve God's gift. All of this she has to give up. Her own strength, her own worthiness must be surrendered. She has to allow that God will do with her whatever he wants. And she will accept. And I'm speaking in feminine because of the Latin anima, soul, but obviously it applies to male and female here. So the soul must learn to accept that if God is to love her, it will be entirely his gift. Nothing in you calls forth God's love. Not your intelligence, not your physical beauty, not your acts of charity, not your acts of self-control. All these don't draw forth God's love. In a kind of surprising twist, sometimes the Carmelites say it's only our nothingness that calls forth God's love, right? God wishes to stoop to nothingness and draw it upwards into his light. So any attachments that the soul has to anything, by however thin a thread of desire, pose a hindrance to God's communication with the soul. The soul must learn to love God only. This dark night is apt to last much longer than the first one, probably several years. However, St. John says, typically it's interspersed with periods of peace and consolation because otherwise the soul could not survive. And so intense is the dark night of the spirit. All right, you can see how this is saying, look, there's only one good and you've got to be purified of every other attachment that you have. And that brings us back to Aquinas and the ultimate end. I left off saying that, Aquinas disagrees with Griset. He thinks he can have it both ways, that there's only one ultimate end that provides us with all satisfaction, and yet we can take satisfaction in other goods. So how is he going to get around this difficulty? Well, each of our powers has a completion to it, and that's a certain good. So even our power to see has the completion of seeing, and that's a certain good. Or the power to imagine has a completion in acts of imagining, and that's a certain good. The idea here is that a power is something directed to an end, and so it's a kind of functional concept, you might say. So a knife has a function of cutting, and so a good knife is going to cut well. A doctor has a function of healing, and so a good doctor is going to heal well. He's going to have knowledge of illness and knowledge of cures, which will make him to be good. These will be completions of him as a doctor. So each capacity that has a tendency to an end ultimately has some completion, and this is a good for us as human beings. Now, this gives us a contrast to a conception of the good that Griset has. Aquinas identifies goods in terms of the purposes he finds in things, that is, in our powers as I've described them. Griset identified goods in terms of our conscious desires, whether that be the emotions or the will. He doesn't often spell out exactly what he's talking about. You might say, Aquinas is saying that what's good for us depends upon the desire of our being, almost, right? What we are. Whereas for Griset, it's just a matter of what we consciously desire. This initial difference on what's good is going to give rise to another difference. They're both going to find multiple inherent goods. Aquinas, because we have multiple powers that can be fulfilled in by different realizations. Griset, because we have different, these sort of basic desires that are connected with basic goods. But Griset is going to have to leave these separate and disparate, whereas Aquinas is going to be able to unite them into a single ultimate end. For Aquinas, the unifying principle is, again, the purposes in things. Not only do we have diverse powers, we ourselves, as a unified being, so there's a diversity to us because we have diverse powers, but we're still one person. Right? As a unified being, we have a single unifying function. Right? We're not a haphazard collection of capacities. We are a single being with a single purpose. I compare this to a complex machine like a car, say, for instance. Different parts of the car have different functions. And so they have different completions, from doors, which have the function of allowing us to get in and out, right? The windshield, which has the function of protecting us from, well, the wind, obviously, from its name, but also rain. Pistons, axles, wheels all have different functions within the whole car. So we can speak of a good or a bad door, a good or a bad windshield, based upon what their function is. But all of these diverse parts are ordered to a single ultimate end, namely transporting people from place to place, right? That's the overall function of the car. And all of the other parts, the door, the windshield, the piston, axle, wheels, and so on, must be evaluated in terms of this one function, right? So if you would have a part that would get in way of the overall function of transportation, then it would ultimately be bad for the whole car. So we have many capacities, just as the car has many parts with different functions. But only ultimately we as individuals are ordered to a single purpose. That single purpose, says Aquinas, will be found in the highest activity of our highest power. That highest power is reason, and the highest activity will be knowing the causes of things, but ultimately knowing the first cause of all things, which is God. Now, if our eye would interfere with the function, overall function of our whole being, well then, as Jesus says, we should pluck it out, right? The eye does have a fulfillment, but that fulfillment is good only insofar as it's ordered further to the one ultimate end. So it's inherently good to see. We all know that, and we wouldn't like the idea of being blind for that very reason. However, our acts of seeing, in the end, are really good for us as a whole, only if they are ordered to God. So if your act of seeing is using pornography or something like that, well, that fulfills just the act of seeing, but it doesn't fulfill your whole person, right? So Aquinas has multiple goods because we have multiple powers, but he also has a single ultimate good that unifies all of them. Now, how can Aquinas speak of multiple satisfactions if there's a single good that provides all satisfaction? So I've got multiple goods with one ultimate good. Now let's turn that from good to satisfaction. Well, the many diverse inherent goods, as we've just said, must be ordered beyond themselves to the good of the whole person. So, if our appetite, namely speaking of the will here, is going to correspond with the reality of how our goods are, then that means that with our will, we're going to take enjoyment in something only if it's ordered to the ultimate end. Going back to the example of using our eyes to look at pornography, if our will is rightly ordered, even though looking at the pornography is a completion of the power of sight, we wouldn't be taking satisfaction in that insofar as it might be ordering us away from the ultimate end of God, right? So every satisfaction and every particular good is a satisfaction also in the ultimate end, or there's something that's skewed, something that's disordered. So our just as the inherent good of individual things all partake in the one ultimate function of our whole being, so our satisfactions in these inherent goods all partake in the satisfaction of the ultimate end. Aquinas actually describes this as an overflowing, right? From our satisfaction in this one great ultimate end that overflows into satisfaction of other things. So if you're taking satisfaction in your friends in an appropriate way, it's as an overflowing of your satisfaction of God. Now, the divine good is possessed most essentially by the act of intellectual act of knowing God, and then following upon that, our act of love. This possession can overflow, says Aquinas, into other goods. We're desiring still to possess God in our friends, right? If we're rightly ordered, we're desiring to possess God in our friends. But we recognize that, yes, our friends are good. They're good, though, again, ultimately, insofar as they themselves participate in God. So I'll open it up for questions. I don't know how long I went. I don't know when I started.
No, that's great. That was 40 minutes. We have time for 15 minutes of questions.
Yes, Trevor.
What you're saying at the beginning. So how would Aquinas approach something like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, talking about like we need these things before we actualize, or like is there a contradiction there, or is there a way to reconcile it?
I think Maslow's hierarchy of needs would be referring to emotional satisfaction, first of all, as opposed to the will. I don't think Maslow has any notion of the will as opposed to the emotions. So there, I think Aquinas would say, no, we don't necessarily have to satisfy various emotions before we can find true fulfillment, because the true fulfillment is going to be found in the will. So, in fact, you might have dissatisfaction in many areas of the emotion, but a more profound satisfaction in the will. Now, that being said, I think Aquinas could be in full agreement that healthy emotional desires are going to be ordered, and that order is going to have to do with a certain hierarchy of goods. Whether that's going to correspond with Maslow or not is another question, right? So the emotions are going to be ordered according to the hierarchy of goods that we've just talked about, of taking satisfaction in things insofar as they fit within the overall good of the individual. Yes?
So that comment by Griset that God does not satisfy all our desires, so obviously it contradicts St. Thomas, but also it seems to contradict most of Catholic and Christian thought, and it strikes me as possibly even heretical. Am I missing something?
Short answer, no. That's exactly what I think. I mean, it's quite disturbing to me, as I say. Actually, Griset, before I came to the University of St. Thomas, I think 2 years or something before I came to the University of St. Thomas, Griset came and he gave a talk called The Restless Heart Blunder, referring to St. Augustine's statement that our hearts are restless. This was a big blunder that had caused all sorts of trouble in the Catholic intellectual tradition. So we have to get over Augustine and learn from Griset instead, I guess. Yes?
Thank you for bringing in the Carmelites. I'm a secular Carmelite. Sometimes mysticism can get a bad rap because it's sometimes seen as like, it's at odds with Thomism. So why is mysticism sometimes given a bad rap, and is there kind of authentic mysticism and then faulty mysticism that can get tied up in the charismatic renewal and the emotions?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So first of all, the word mysticism is batted around out there in all kinds of different ways, right? And I think most commonly people think mysticism of having visions of God or something like that. So something like a St. Faustina seeing Christ or something along this line, or even visions of Mary at Fatima or something like that. As used within the Carmelite tradition, that's not what mysticism is about. Mysticism is about a certain kind of prayer, and ultimately it's a prayer in which God is very active, as opposed to here in the beginner stage, in the beginner's prayer, the beginner himself is very active in his prayer, which is good. I mean, it's not inappropriate that's the case, right? But what happens is God more and more takes over, and God is as I say, moving the heart, and then in the head there is really just this effective knowledge that we become aware of our love and thereby become aware of God, who we are loving. And that's mysticism in the Carmelite tradition. And when you look at it in the more popular vision, yeah, that leads to all sorts of confusions, unfortunately, and maybe even a bad rap, as you say. So mysticism, in the first sense, St. John of the Cross says, is something that none of us should want, right? We should not want to have visions, right? I mean, if God gives them to us, okay, we might accept that, right? Okay, but we should not want to have visions. If that's what you mean by mysticism, none of us should want to be a mystic. Mysticism in the second sense, we should all want to be mystics in this sense. We shouldn't suppose that that's something just for Carmelite monks or nuns living apart from the world. It's for all of us living in the world, right? Now, as far as the charismatic aspect, that probably is getting the emotions a lot into play in the charismatic aspect. So it's something that I think, you know, St. John would probably put at the beginner stage, you know, which isn't to say that it's bad, right? But there's purification that would happen.
So I'm curious what the interplay would be between purgatory and the dark night of the soul, perhaps. Those who are beginners will do their dark night of the soul in purgatory if they die in that state, or the perfect won't need purgatory, or...
I would say purgatory is a different sort of thing. Not entirely, in the sense that any kind of suffering is a kind of purgation, right? But what's going on here is the person is being moved more and more by God. And Father is going to be talking about the gifts of the Holy Spirit. And I believe you are. Yes. Right. So basically, what's going on in this movement here is the person is becoming more and more moved by God with the gifts of the Holy Spirit. Right. In purgatory, your time to grow and be moved more and more by God is past, right? So there isn't the kind of growth in purgatory that one finds in these dark nights. Okay, both of them, however, would, you know, cleanse you of imperfect desires. So in that sense, there's a certain parallel that goes on. Yes.
So it seems to me like this sort of movement might be like bringing us towards the fullness of life. As soon as you go through the three stages of spiritual development, we're sort of bowing to ourselves, to our senses, to our soul, and or to our will. I mean, and I think at some point you could kind of understand this as well. Like, well, we just have to just appreciate, just love God, right? And you know, forget all the senses, forget everything else. But you know, that doesn't quite sound satisfying, right? So it seems like it has to come full circle into I guess properly ordering the senses and the will, so that we can partake in perhaps, like you mentioned, like the friendships properly and actually enjoy them. Is that what it's getting at? Like, yeah, but you got to get to a point where you love God so much that it is, you'll take satisfaction in solely Him. But then, because we're human, we also need these other things.
I mean, you're gonna. What it would be is. Look, if you have a great meal at some point after you've gone through these dark nights and reached the stage of perfection, you're going to enjoy the meal entirely insofar as this is a way of participating in God. Right? So it would not, coming back to the question of Trevor earlier, it wouldn't be just that as a human being you need your Maslowian satisfaction of a certain hierarchy of things or something like that. In a certain sense, and of course part of what's going on here is a division between the natural and supernatural, which Father also spoke about last night, I believe, right? So in a certain sense, at the supernatural level, all of these other things are going to be put on the wayside. Whatever kind of, you might say, naturally what I could get by with, right, is, you know, know, I couldn't get by if I didn't enjoy my meals or something like that. But at the supernatural level, you're going to be able to get by without enjoying your meals.
Could you comment on, well, St. Thomas says that the growth in charity is not tied to natural capacities in the human person, that charity can outstrip limitations of knowledge, for example, or a psychological capacity. How would we put that together with the idea that the dark night of the soul is structural, progressive, and therefore seems to presuppose a certain state of human maturity and life and experience. What am I thinking? With Teresa had spiritual child. She's, Teresa, the child Jesus. She was in some ways psychologically childlike, and yet she was a great mystic. Can you be a great mystic and yet not have gone through human formation that equips you to bear these graces?
Yeah, again, you're looking at supernatural level here, and of course you're looking at the will most profoundly here, right? So as you say, it's not your intellectual capacity or anything like that that's really going to matter here. The kind of knowledge that you have of God in these dark nights and really effectively in the spiritual life after all the way down here is this kind of effective knowledge. So it's not going to be intellectually figuring out something about God, right? It's going to be that your heart is resting in God, and with your mind, you're aware that you're resting in God, and so you become aware of God that's present to you in your own love, so to speak. So what will matter is the depth of your love, right? Whatever your intellectual capacities, whatever your human training might be, the depth of your love is going to determine the depth of your knowledge in this way.
So St. John talks about the dark nights being a passive form of purification, as meaning that they arise in God, right? Or they come from God.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that even the soul is sort of unaware of God as they're happening. The soul might be unaware of God's activity in herself. But it seems like there still must be like an active response to God in order to grow.
Like
a response to grace on our part.
There's always cooperation and grace that's going to be present, right? There always has to be that, but that's the, I think, some of the mystery of cooperation, right? In the sense that more and more it's God moving you and you're not saying no. Okay. So with the gifts of the Holy Spirit, it's God sort of reaching right into your soul and moving you to something, whatever the different things might be. You still have the capacity to say no. But if you don't say no, then His movement flows through you.
Okay.
And you have. So,
we have time for one more question.
Well, I saw you in the last evening.
So I was wondering if you could say a bit more about the idea of like the love of God overflowing into love of friends or other human ends. And specifically, I guess it seems like one might be worried that if it's the love of God overflowing, then even if it's permissible or something, or like there's some value in our loving our friends or loving the pleasures of a good meal or whatever, it becomes sort of pointless. Like, maybe you could if you really wanted to, but why would you bother if the love of God considered in itself is sufficient to satisfy?
Well, yeah. Where's my high tech here? There it is. We don't have much high tech.
Poor God.
All right, so Aquinas will distinguish between the good thing and the possession of it. So if the good thing is money, that's what the miser wants. But he doesn't want just lots of money existing. He wants to have it, right? So it doesn't make a good miser if he just says, oh, yeah, I want you to have lots of money. No, he wants to possess it himself, right? And so it is with all goods. There's the good thing and the possession of it. And that includes God. So if the good thing is God, well, there's still our possession of it. And this is by way of knowing and loving. Right? So now, what comes about is the fact that we are one being, and so we have this unified order to this one good. But we want to possess this good, and this is the essential way of possessing it, you might say. Okay. But we're more complex than that, right? We're bodily beings with lots of aspects to us. And so if we really want to possess it wholly and entirely, we're going to want this essential possession to overflow into the other aspects of our life, right? So it's not just that, now I can kind of somehow subsume my enjoyment of my health or of my good meals into God. We want it to overflow so that we as these unified but yet complex beings can possess this good most completely. All right, thank you. All right.